The public policy implications of the gender identity controversy.
Most medical professionals in the field think that reinforcing gender dysphoria in a child is wrong, it's bad. A better way to do it is actually to gently reinforce gender stereotypes. And yet Ontario passed a law that makes it illegal now. You can't do that anymore.
On the feature today, Andre Schouten on a new ARPA policy report on the gender issue. In the news, a mixed ruling in Nova Scotia on the Trinity Western Law School case, an update on some summertime activities from We Need a Law, and a win for religious free speech in St. Catharines, Ontario.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
You may have heard this already, but the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal is in with its ruling in the Trinity Western Law School case. The ruling upheld a lower court decision which would allow graduates of that proposed law school to hang out a shingle in Nova Scotia. ARPA was one of the interveners in that case. Lawyer Andre Schouten says while the ruling is interesting, it wasn't really everything he was looking for.
The Nova Scotia Court of Appeal affirmed the outcome of the lower court, but did so by only focusing in on the more technical legal questions. And they specifically said we don't need to answer the deeper constitutional questions. So in that sense, it's a little disappointing. It's disappointing that we didn't get a nice, robust ruling on religious freedom or on freedom of association or on the equality rights of Christians to be treated fairly by the state, but I guess a win is better than no win at all.
The whole accreditation thing is working its way through the courts in three provinces. We're still awaiting an appeals court decision from BC. In Ontario, the appeals court has upheld the decision not to accredit graduates of the law school. Schouten says this will likely send the case on to the highest court of the land.
Now that we have two different provincial courts of appeal with two different responses, two different answers to this question, it's very likely that the Supreme Court will hear the appeal. And then whether or not they actually grant the appeal or not remains to be seen.
It's summertime. That means a lot of folks are taking time off, but not the people that We Need a Law. Director Mike Schouten was in Ottawa last month answering questions posed by some government lawyers from Ontario. At issue, the upcoming court case on Ontario's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. The act is written to specifically exempt the release of any information having to do with abortion statistics. And that's why Mike had to go to Ottawa.
Part of the legal challenge was a series of affidavits, and one of those was prepared on my behalf. And a quick summary of my affidavit was that the work that I direct for ARPA Canada with the We Need a Law campaign, we advocate for preborn children, and because we're not allowed or cannot ascertain the correct information, that interferes with our ability to educate and inform the public, and it also interferes with our ability to effectively advocate for these preborn children directly to government on their behalf. The lawyer for the Ontario government was unclear on certain aspects of the affidavit, so he wanted to examine me on some portions of that, and that's why I was in Ottawa.
There's a date now for the actual court case. Arguments due to be heard in early February. Meantime, We Need a Law researcher Anna Nienhuis has been busy putting together a brief to the government of Prince Edward Island as it finalizes its regulations on the provision of abortion in that province. Anna says there's some history here.
PEI has been the last holdout province to be a holdout for life, that they have never had abortion access on the island until now. Overall, the feel on the island seems to still be that most people still like their pro-life stance, and so many of the options people have to go off-island are still very close.
As to the recommendations, there's four of them.
Basically, what we're recommending is that they'll make sure every client has access to mandatory, unbiased counseling. And in conjunction with that, there'd be a 24-hour waiting period after requesting an abortion so that we can really ensure there's no coercion happening and that they're having time to process and think about it with the help of a professional to help process their emotions. We're also asking that they continue to refer abortions after 14 weeks to the Moncton Hospital in New Brunswick. That's where people currently go past 14 weeks. So then they would still be doing only the earliest ones on the island. And then that parental notification be ensured before abortion is granted to a minor.
And one thing more this week, a win for religious free speech in St. Catharines, Ontario. The win involves a lady named Mary Stanko. For almost 20 years, she's been publishing a community newsletter and leaving copies on the literature rack at the local public library for anybody to pick up. That was all well and good until this spring when she included an editorial in the newsletter about the supremacy of God provision in the Charter of Rights and critique the abandonment of God in society. The library refused to allow that particular newsletter to stay on the literature rack. That prompted a letter from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms explaining the library's duty as a government body to not censor materials based on the content of the views expressed. The case never did go to court. The library board contacted its lawyers and promptly backed down. Back with more after this.
The House of Commons rose for the summer on Friday, June 17th, and most MPs will be spending considerable time in their ridings this summer. Take this opportunity to meet with your MP, attend an event that they are hosting or that they will be at, or organize one of your own. Continue to build your relationship with your MP while they're in your riding so that you can continue to engage with them when they return to work on the Hill this fall.
And we're back on the program. Late last month, ARPA released its latest policy paper. This one is about the issue of transgenderism, how society should approach it, and more specifically, how governments should look at this issue. ARPA lawyer Andre Schutten was the lead author on the paper, which you can find on the ARPA homepage. We also linked to it from our page this week. Andre is on the line from his office in Ottawa. First of all, sir, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me again, Al.
You want to just run through the basics of the report? I mean, there's a bunch of recommendations at the end, but let's kind of start at the beginning and define what it is we're talking about here.
Right. So the report, perhaps to take a step back from that yet, the report is intended for policymakers across the country, so both federal members of parliament and senators, as well as provincial MLAs or MPPs. And it's also intended for lay people, you know, our Christian supporters, for example, sitting in the pew, to be able to read this policy report and try to come to understand or grasp the basics of what's at stake in this question of gender identity, which is a new and live issue for Canadians. It's something that's really come to the fore in the last 5 years or so. And so we start off our report just by asking the simple question, what is transgenderism? What is it that we're talking about? And it's a big umbrella term that includes a whole rainbow of different types of identities or expressions where there's some form of incongruence or difference between the biological sexual marker of either male or female, and then the expression of that, where that expression is a little different, or sometimes very, very different, the exact opposite of what it is that they are sexually according to biology. So we just kind of talk about some of the science there, how often it manifests and what's going on as far as psychological or biological differences.
And that question of, you know, how many people are affected, I mean, it's a very, very, very small proportion of the population according to the statistics I read in the report, and yet it's getting all this political attention. How many people are actually affected by this, by the best estimates we can find?
Well, it is a hard question to answer, but according to the DSM-5, which is, you know, the Bible for psychologists and psychiatrists, they say for adult men who have gender dysphoria, it's only 0.005% to 0.014%, so a small fraction, and it's even less for adult women. So we're talking minuscule. 1 in 1,000 is a generous estimate. It's more likely to be 1 in 10,000.
And yet this issue is getting all this attention. A lot of people, I think, shake their heads at that. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, from my perspective as a Christian, I don't mind that exceptional cases get exceptional attention so much. I think you and I will know all kinds of people that have exceptional needs or exceptional circumstances, and they do require exceptional attention. When it comes to this, though, this issue, gender identity, transgenderism, gender dysphoria, the problem, the issue arises, is where it's become very, very politicized. So we have a particular group of vocal advocates who have jumped on this bandwagon and are using transgendered individuals, particularly transgendered youth, as political pawns to advance a particular agenda. And that agenda is to deconstruct or destroy the idea of gender or sex as being a binary reality. That means that either we are male or we are female. That's a biological reality. It's something that we as Christians know to be reality because that's the way God has created humankind. And there's some people, a very small, in my opinion, vocal minority, who feel that that binary needs to be destroyed or eliminated.
You know, one of the things I saw in there, and it really struck me, was your reference to a potenophilia, which is the disorder that says somebody has a desire to have a specific limb amputated. You also talk about anorexia and say, you know, we don't give liposuction to an anorexic because they think they're fat. I mean, that's part of the problem as well, is it not? Is that we're sort of redefining this whole thing from a medical condition to a how do I feel about myself, and I have to act upon that feeling. That's kind of fundamental.
No, exactly. So I use in the report a comparison to apotemnophilia, which is a desire to have a particular limb amputated. Another more popular phrase has been the transabled, people who aren't disabled but want to be disabled. And there is no logical, consistent public policy reason to say no to apotemnophilia or to say no to transableism, but to say yes to transgenderism, like from a public policy perspective. And really, when we compare transgenderism or gender dysphoria in particular in teenagers and in children, and we compare that to anorexia, then what is the compassionate response to that? It's not a perfect analogy, I'll grant that, but it's an analogy that makes the point that sometimes, or maybe every time, that there's a psychological disorder that is not matching up with reality. So either they see themselves as obese when they're gaunt, or they see themselves as male when they're actually female, or vice versa. Then maybe the compassionate thing is to not indulge in the fantasy, but rather to try to correct it.
Okay, so let's get to the solution. There's a number of recommendations at the end of the report. Can you kind of sum it up? What kind of approach should we be taking with this?
The approach that we need to take has to be motivated, first of all, by compassion. In the report, I spend a good 2 pages or so talking about how helping has hurt. In the medical literature, I think the preponderance of the evidence points us to the conclusion that, in fact, when we try to accommodate or celebrate some of these things where people are expressing themselves in the opposite gender and so on, it actually does more harm than good. So our recommendations focus in 2 different areas. The first 6 recommendations focus on protecting transgendered youth in particular. And again, the medical evidence suggests that 80% of the time, gender dysphoria in a child will resolve on its own without any form of medical intervention, will resolve on its own by the time the child hits puberty. So the first starting point is to say, as a state in particular, and we're seeing this in the education system and in some of the medical institutions in this country, and certainly in some secular families, when a child, a toddler, says that they're the opposite gender, leave it alone. Let time take its course. And by the time the child hits puberty, there's an 80% chance that that's going to resolve and no harm done. What we're seeing instead, though, is that education institutions are reinforcing the dysphoria at a very early age, which just compounds the problem. So right there, we say, back off on the kids, leave the kids alone. And then the second set of recommendations, recommendations 7 to 10, focus more on the big pictures. And that is that we need to rethink some of the laws that have been passed in the last little while. For example, Ontario passed a law last year that made it illegal to counsel for gender reinforcement in children. So most medical professionals in the field, not all, but most, think that reinforcing gender dysphoria in a child is wrong. It's bad. A better way to do it is actually to gently reinforce gender stereotypes. So if there is an issue where a child is identifying as the opposite sex, there are gentle things we can do to reinforce the gendered stereotype. And when that happens, there's usually a very high rate of success. It's not perfect, doesn't work all the time, but it's non-invasive. It's a very gentle form of gender reinforcement. And yet Ontario passed a law that was introduced by one of the most radical activists on this file, a woman by the name of Sherry DeNovo. And she advances a law that makes it illegal now. You can't do that anymore, which does way more harm than good. So we want provinces and the federal government to rethink some of their laws. And then in the end, we conclude that in the interim, while we reshift, we reorient our public policy, in the interim, we just need to balance rights a little better. And so where there's spaces that are public spaces, where there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, we need to go back to what has always been our position, and that is that change rooms, washrooms, shower rooms, locker rooms, etc., where there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, that there in those places, biological markers have to be the determining factor, because that's the objective measurement, and that's how we protect women and children in those vulnerable situations.
Sure, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Al.
Again, a programming note to close. We're still on summer production schedule here. The next edition of Lighthouse News due to be delivered in 2 weeks on Tuesday, August 23rd. Talk to you again then.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpaccanada.ca. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks for another edition of Lighthouse News.